Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about eating away at cognitive decline, Rus University Medical Center, and how regular consumption of spicy foods is linked to lower risk of death, Chinese Academy of Medical Sciences, and how mindfulness-based stress reduction therapy helps post-traumatic stress disorder among veterans from the Minneapolis Veterans Affairs Health Center, and a lot more on health and healing. Also today, we're going to look at how the American Psychological Association lost its way. A special comment in the Los Angeles Times from Roy Idelson and Jean-Meyer Arrigo. We're going to look at also how cables show that Hillary Clinton's State Department, under her leadership, was deeply involved in the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Thank you, David Sorda, for doing a really good job on this, because now she's out there acting like she cares about anyone. She doesn't. And she has surrounded herself with a beehive colony of worker bees and drones to try to convince you that she's actually against the abuse of the American public. She isn't. I'll give you the proof today, because she stated on 45 separate occasions, when meeting with leaders of countries, including those who are part of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, that she's all in on it. So that's her actual position. What she says to the contrary is just the politics of theater. So we'll explore that. Also from our environmental segment today, battered by drought, forests lose their ability to fend off climate change. From Andrea Germanos. Why? What happens when a tree is in drought? I'll share that in depth. Also today is a mandatory DNA database for all Americans coming soon. Yes. And from Dar Jamel, the new climate normal is going to see big rises in the sea level and predictions of various civilization collapses in different parts of the world. Not for everyone. Plus, we're going to be hearing from a leading nurse, and good for this group. They do good work. Nurses Against Mandatory Vaccination. And we're also going to hear from a inner city detective about the war on drugs, which I believe should be stopped, should never have been. Let all those involved out of prison and start helping people instead of punishing them. If time permits today, the making of an American police state. How did we end up with millions behind bars and police armed like soldiers? From Jacobin Magazine, Kristen Parente. Let's begin. We have a lot to share. Plus, I have a guest, an ophthalmologist, holistic ophthalmologist, going to talk about taking care of your eyes a little later on in the program. I'm working right now with someone with cognitive decline. Here's the interesting part. 2 years ago, I invited some people whose family members, a mother or father, suffered from some form of cognitive decline or Alzheimer's, to do a one-month intensive retreat. I donated my time, brought together some really good healthcare professionals, and one of the people came with their mother. The mother was in decline, but still had cognition. You could carry on a conversation. And I said, now's the time. You can't realize how fast that decline comes when you're not doing something proactive. They stayed less than 6 hours and left. The reason? They didn't believe that they could stick to a strict protocol. Okay, that's fine. The person just showed up. The mother is in full full Alzheimer's, doesn't recognize her daughter or son, both of whom accompanied her, and wanders away. Whole lot more challenging now. So here is the message for everyone out there. You must take extreme steps when you're dealing with an extreme disease in a natural way to rebalance the body. Trying to do it simply doesn't work. Now, the Rush University Medical Center has this to say, quote, while cognitive abilities naturally diminish as part of the normal aging process, it may be possible to slow this down. Eating a group of specific foods known as MIND diet, M-I-N-D, may slow cognitive decline among aging adults, even when the person is not at risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. That's according to research from research at Rush University Medical Center. Now, here's what they're using, and this was published in the Journal of Alzheimer's and Dementia, the Journal of the Alzheimer's Association. They're using a two-pronged diet, one that tells you five food groups to stay away from that you shouldn't have at all, and others that you can have. All right, so I examine the group, and the group that you can have are, they're pretty good. They're like the Mediterranean diet, and I would agree with them. A wine, but no cheese. Now, of course, I would be more specific. Is that wine that's organic at low alcohol content, down around 2%, that's made from organic grapes and no sulfites? Yeah, I would agree. If it's a commercial wine that has a lot of preservatives in it, including sulfates that can destroy brain cells, the answer is no. But more important than the wine, grapes. More important than the grapes, grape juice, organic grape juice. That's a brain-healthy food. They also say stay away from red meat, butter, stick margarine, cheese, pastries, and sweets, and fried or fast food. Right on. That they're right on. Then they say the foods that you can also have, they're emphasizing nuts, good. Beans, great. Poultry, no. Berries, at least twice a week. How about twice a day? And so none of these universities or institutions are going to go to any extreme. They can't. And even if they wanted to. And that's a different topic dealing with, let me try to give you the overview on this. When we are faced with a major life-threatening illness, maybe we've had a stroke or a heart attack, cancer, kidney failure. More often than not, we're given medicines, 99% of the time medicines, and the medicines are extremely radical on the body. Sometimes they can be beneficial. More often than not, they actually exacerbate the condition. Like chemotherapy can shrink a cancer, and they think that's a good thing. But then the immune system collapses, the cancer comes back, and they have no immunity, and the person dies a second time around. Again, they'll go at chemotherapy or radiation, but the person by that time is on the way out. If you said, let's change the diet, the first pushback you get is, okay, well, what do you mean change the diet? Well, let's give up everything that's harmful, everything that contributes to inflammation, which can lead to the destruction of the cell, which can lead then to cancer. Or anything that's destroying the epithelium, that is causing blood thickening, that can cause blood clots, that can cause a stroke or heart attack. So let's give that up. What are you talking about? Well, French fries, hot dogs, hamburgers, bagels, pretzels, pizzas, bread, sugars, artificial sweeteners, caffeine, coffee, alcohol. Well, that's extreme. I can't do that. I hear it every day. I heard it yesterday counseling someone. I can't give up meat. You know, my family expects meat three times a day. I have to give them meat. So I'll give them some organic meat. That won't make a big difference. If you looked at organic meat, which is grass-fed, or you looked at, you know, commercial meat that is factory-farmed and given soybeans, the meat is going to do the same thing in the person's body, whether it has a hormone or not. And it's going to have too much protein, arachidonic acid, saturated fat, causing inflammation in your arteries, your brain, your joints. Now, you can justify it. You can rationalize it. You can say, because my religion or my beliefs or my family, I have to have it. Fine. But unless you make a radical change in your patterns, you will not reverse the disease, which is hyper-radical. And it leads to the ultimate radical, death. So what's amazing is what stands between a radicalized process, disease, and death. And where our mind is, I don't want to be too radical at doing anything. Well, friend, if you don't want to be too radical, you already are. You're the extreme radical. Disease does not compromise with your political, religious, ideological, or personal views. It's going to kill you, and it's going to beat the hell out of you in the process. It's going to take you like a rag doll and smash you against a wall until you bleed. And then that process that we as a nation accept, and all the doctors accept it, and the nurses accept it, and the professors, and the scientists, and the politicians, and the media, accept that that is a normal process. And the drugs they give you frequently are worse than the disease or exacerbate the disease. Think of depression. Think of arthritis. Think of heart disease. Think of cancer. Now think of the treatments, as bad as or as worse than the condition. Yet, change your diet. Really clean it up. Eat more raw foods, living food. Oh, man, I got to stay away from you. That's too radical. Well, okay. But I'd like to introduce you at some point to the daughter who thought that changing the diet would be too radical, and the son who agreed, and now today, 2 years later, watch them chase after their mother. Watch them try to speak with her. Who are you? Who are you? I'm your son. No, you're not. Now, that's happening 5 million times a day in the United States. So you want to see hyper-radical? Deal with someone with advanced Alzheimer's or dementia, and you'll see it. Now you want to be ultra-conservative in health? Just understand, look at your constraints, and that's your future. So how would I go about dealing with this? I only deal in extremes. I'm not the person to see if you want to be very conservative and very cautious, because the energy needed to change the DNA, the energy of the metabolism, the energy of the cell, the process of the disease, you have to exceed that. I call it the laws of compensation. To the degree that anything is causing an imbalance in your system, whether it's from an accident or genetics or viruses or bacteria, you must exceed it. What proof do I have that it works? Well, how about more people alive today using holistic protocols for AIDS than any other place on the planet? People actually reversed full-blown AIDS, every single symptom, and the medical verification documentation, their medical records, to prove it. How about reversing a lot of diseases? That was not done by small or trite or incremental change. It was massive. Now, for the other people who didn't want to do that, they had improvements, but not reversal. With Alzheimer's, I put them on a high raw food diet for the first month, juicing as they've never juiced in their life, chelating out, using EDTA, suppositories, nutrients, homeopathics, to get the heavy metal out, remove the mercury fillings from the teeth, get the mercury out of the brain, rebuild their intestine, rebuild the immune system in the intestine, flood the body with probiotics, help their digestive system, calm their digestive system, normalize their digestive system, detoxify, make sure that they have the nutrients in the diet, and then compensate above that, because there is no diet I'm aware of in the world that was going to reverse these diseases. All it will do with the best diet is slow it down a bit. It will not reverse it. That's why I tell people not to follow a macrobiotic diet if you want to reverse disease. You can improve your health, but it's going to continue to get worse over time because you're not rebuilding the DNA. Acetylcholine, 500 milligrams, three times a day on an empty stomach. That's important in helping to reverse dementia. Acetyl-L-carnitine that enhances brain metabolism and slows down deterioration of the memory and reduces production of free radicals. Boron, improving memory function. Coenzyme A that supports the immune system. Coenzyme Q10 at very high doses improves oxygenation of the brain cells. Folic acid, which is very important to control homocysteine, which is rampant in people with brain disorders. So if they don't die of the Alzheimer's, they die of heart disease from the nutrient deficiencies. Iron, lecithin, phosphatidylserine, which improves memory, and pycnogenol, which is a very powerful and a very healing nutrient that passes the blood-brain barrier to protect your brain cells from free radical damage. SAMe, which is very important to lower homocysteine. Trimethylglycine, which utilizes B12, folic acid, and B6. Vitamin A and B-complex, and even injectable B12 and glutathione, and apple pectin, and hyperazine A, which improves cognitive function and improves short-term memory. Melatonin and superoxide dismutase, and very important, high dose, starting at 6,000 and going upwards, vitamin C to bowel tolerance. And then butcher's broom to promote your circulation, and curry. And for cognitive function, the curcuminoids, ginkgo biloba, and also I would use probably the Chinese herb quinsentao, that's TA, and that is very important for increasing memory, and valerian root. So those are just some of the things, not all by any means. So when I read a study where they're taking a very cautious and a very conservative perspective, you're dealing with a very radical, unrelenting, unapologetic, and never-ceasing disease process. And we just don't understand natural healing in our society. Also, the regular consumption of spicy foods is linked to a lower risk of death. This is in the Chinese Academy of Medicine. Quote, what they observed in this study is that, basing it upon previous science, that spices have very specific bioactive ingredients like capsaicin, and that helps with if you're overweight, if you want something that's anti-inflammatory and anti-cancer. And a team of researchers led by the Chinese Academy of Medical Sciences, that's their highest scientific body, gave a group of individuals, not a small group, 487,000 individuals, for 4 years, these spices, and then they looked at all the other things in their diet, how much red meat, vegetables, alcohol they consumed, and they found that when you're getting rid of the meat and the alcohol and you're increasing the spices, you can have a substantial benefit in overall mortality. Quote, frequent consumption of spicy food was also linked to a lower risk of death from cancer and ischemic heart and respiratory system diseases, and this is more evident in women than men. Fresh dried chili peppers were the most commonly used spices in those who reported eating spicy foods weekly. I would agree, that's a good diet. And finally, from Minneapolis Veterans Affairs Healthcare Center, published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, mindfulness-based meditation causes stress reduction, and that decreases post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms. And that's what their study showed. And they had a substantial decrease in stress manifestation when you do simple things like just mindful meditation. Now, I led a mindful meditation this morning. I took people out on the road to, first I took them out yesterday, and we're doing a retreat as a fundraiser for our sister station to help them. And the good news is that yesterday we paid, my office paid for 173 premiums to be shipped out for listeners. And today I think they're doing 200. That wouldn't have been possible without the retreat. So it's made a big difference. In any case, the people are on the road. And at the end of it, I said, how was the walk? Okay. And then today, as we were ready to go up this beautiful country road in the mountains, I said, I'd like for you to do something different. I'd like for you just to stop, close your eyes, and just remain still for about a minute or two. And when they opened their eyes, I said, now, how many bird sounds did you hear? Oh, you know, four? Seven? There were actually 11. Now, yesterday when you went on the road to walk, you were talking. How many of you saw the mare chasing after its mother? The little filly chasing after its mother? Where? How many of you saw the two eagles? Where? How many of you heard the message in the wind? Is it the warm wind as it went through the trees, the tall pines, the 180-foot pines? How many of you have smelt the clover as we went by a field where you could look 60 miles out into, or 30 miles out at least, into the, down a valley? No one saw any of it. Here's what I explained, and I'll explain this also. Maybe it may mean something to someone listening. When you eat and you talk, your attention is divided. It's divided on the conversation and on the food. When you don't talk when you eat and just are mindfulness, mindful in the moment, a meditation while eating, you're conscious of the flavors, the mouthfeel. You can take your time. You can chew longer, get better digestion. You're more relaxed. Your blood pressure is lower. Your stress levels are lower, and you appreciate the food because you're becoming what you're eating. But when you're talking and eating, you don't remember the conversation, and you don't remember the food because your energy is broken, just like yesterday. So today, when we went out on the road, and the people were walking, and we came back, I said, now, what'd you experience? And one person said, wow, it's just breathtaking. I counted 9 horses in one pasture, and yeah, I saw the two little horses rushing, running around playing, and then running over to their mother. And someone else said, and I saw the eagles. And everyone felt the breeze, and everyone smelt the wonderful smell of hay drying at this time of year after it'd been baled. And I said, so this is a mindful meditation, simply being mindful of the moment you're in, relaxing yourself and staying focused on this moment, not your problems, not your worries, not what you left at home, but in this moment. So the first day, second day, third day, people were talking while eating. Now, yesterday, they didn't. Completely different experience. They could actually taste the food. They could appreciate it, looking at it, piece of artwork. Every plate was plated like it was a beautiful gourmet 5-star meal. Totally different experience. Wonderful, healthy, vegan food, but a different experience because mindfulness. So here is the point. They now found that mindfulness meditation can help reduce stress in Gulf War vets. So when I was in Florida, I met with a group of Gulf War vets, and I said, how do you spend your day? The guy said, well, see that pile there? Yeah. Well, we just keep adding to it. It was a pile of beer cans, and it was about 6 feet high, and I'm guessing 10 feet across. And they would just drink beer and are angry. all day long. I said, would you be willing to do something different, even if it didn't change your circumstance, it could change how you feel about life? Most were not interested, but three guys were. I said, you're only a half a mile from the ocean. Why don't you go into the ocean each day? There's a shower down there, public shower. You can take a shower and clean up, go in for a swim, come back, and just sit there and just relax and look at the waves. Feel the energy. And I said, then you've got a choice. You put your mind in a positive place. And some younger guy, I guess he's in his late 20s, a vet, he had an interesting story. He lived by sneaking into people's lawns and taking fruit off trees. And he'd only take one piece of fruit off a tree so nobody would miss it. And he was dead broke, and he couldn't get a job. And he said, I never thought our society would treat us like this. But he had been going to the beach, and he had been swimming. And he hadn't done the meditation part, but he was then going to take him out and do a meditation and then hopefully get some of the guys away from drinking the beer, sitting there being angry and depressed, and said, go out and enjoy that part. So you can't change everything in life. We're not always possible. It's not always possible to change all the circumstances in our life, but you can sure change how you're going to feel that day by doing something constructive or positive. And I said also, you're all homeless. You're out here. Why don't you go to the homeless shelters and the homeless soup kitchens and volunteer your time? They need help. They have employed people or retired people coming in to serve you all meals. Why don't you go and volunteer your time? And they go around, pick up clothes, and see the clothes are washed and then sorted so people who don't have clothes can get clothes. And they give haircuts. You can help with haircuts, you can help with clothes, you can help cook the food, go to different places and get the food. There's so much you could be doing in the daytime, but you're sitting here drinking beer, staying angry, and that's not going to lead you to any place good. So mindfulness as a meditation is extraordinarily important. I'm Gary Noll. We're going to take a brief break and come back, and when we come back, we're going to go directly into a nurse, Michelle Ralton of Nurses Against Mandatory Vaccines. Whistleblower talking about vaccines and newborns and why they're so dangerous.
Joining us on the phone is Michelle Ralton, and she is the founder, I believe, of Nurses Against Mandatory Vaccines. We spoke to her back on May the 1st because it's very important, as we see all these bills coming across the United States for mandatory vaccines, to understand this has been going on for a long time. And of course, it's not just in schools, as we're seeing the main thrust right now. It's been against people in the health professions, especially telling them they could not work unless they got vaccines. So we talked to her about that initially, and she had a bombshell revelation within that context, telling us about the harmful effects that she had witnessed firsthand on children in neonatal intensive care, premature infants, who were given the vaccines on schedule regardless of their physical condition. And of course, their physical condition was not the same as a baby that had gone full term that was 2 months old. These were children that were born prematurely, and even though they were born just a couple of months ago, they were still on the same vaccine schedule. Now, before we get into the interview, with an update from the Journal of the American Medical Association validating what Michelle had said, when I give you her qualifications, of course, she is a Master of Science in Nursing. We have a lot of initials after her name. I just want you to understand what these are if you're not a medical professional. The Master Science in Nursing, Registered Nurse Certified, a Nursing Interventions Classification Certification, Certified in Neonatal Pediatric Support, and a Neonatal Nurse Practitioner with Board Certification. Michelle is highly qualified, highly trained, but most importantly, she has an ethics and a morality that we see lacking in pretty much every field today, but especially now in medicine. When she blew the whistle on this practice, when she put herself out there and talked about things that other people weren't doing, it's very, very important, because if you don't have ethics, if you don't have morality, all the training and certification and knowledge that you get just makes you more dangerous. And that's what we're seeing right now in the medical profession. So joining us now is Michelle Roden with Nurses Against Mandatory Vaccines. Thank you for joining us, Michelle.
Thank you for having me. I just wanted to make a correction that I'm not the founder of Nurses Against Mandatory Vaccines. I'm a founding board member, so I'm one of the original board members, but Amy Kenyon is actually the founder.
Okay, good. Now, I want to go back and recall for our viewers what you told us on May 1st that you had seen being done with young babies, premature babies who were suffering in the neonatal intensive care, what they were saying about vaccines at the time.
Well, I had mentioned that they go ahead and vaccinate premature infants on time, meaning that once they are 2 months old, they're ready for their two-month vaccines, regardless of the fact that they may still have supposed to have been inside their mother's stomachs and not even born yet. Mm-hmm. And some of the things that we're seeing and are being said are things like a neonatologist calling from the step-down unit down to level three to the more intensive unit saying, hey, I'm going to give these four babies their two-month vaccines this weekend, so I just want to make sure you had four beds ready because we know they're all going to have issues and need increased care.
And that was bombshell information, because that violates one of the core ethics of the medical foundation profession that we've always seen, and that is first do no harm. They knew this was going to harm the children, but they were going to go ahead and blindly or follow this schedule.
Absolutely. You know, and I mentioned that I had sat in a call room before with a bunch of providers saying, hey, we have this 25-weeker that was so strong, they never required intubation with a breathing tube to actually go onto the vent, had a less invasive type respiratory support. And you come in and they're like, oh, how embarrassing. We gave that baby his 2 month immunizations and now he's intubated on the vent for the first time. Oops.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of blown off.
That was amazing. So you told us that on May 1st. And then you contacted me last week and told me about this JAMA study, a Journal of American Medical Association, the official organization of MDs, and here they do a study about the adverse effects after routine immunization of extremely low birth weight infants. Tell us about that study.
Well, first, extremely low birth weight infants are 28 weeks in gestation or less, or under 1,000 grams, approximately 2.2 pounds or less at birth. And you had a group of physicians and a practitioner that went into a database of a large neonatology corporation with almost 14,000 infants looked at. And what the results said were that they were looking at the pre-immunization period versus the post-immunization period, and their sepsis workups went up 3.7 times in the post-immunization period. And sepsis means a blood infection. And so there was multiple labs drawn, blood cultures, urine cultures. They go ahead and they start those babies on antibiotics right away while they wait for results. So it's not a benign thing.
Yeah, it's life-threatening, isn't it?
Right. It's life-threatening. And even if it ends up not being an infection, they've still had pain, they've had invasive procedures, and they've had antibiotics given, which is not a benign thing for these babies that have very sensitive intestines. And so it's a big deal. And then we had increased respiratory support 2 times higher in the post-immunization period. And then intubation, actually getting intubated with a breathing tube and going on the vent, was about 1.7, 1.8 times higher. And what really shocked me, I had to read it about three times, was when I got down to the conclusion, they said, based on this, there was no difference in reaction between single shots and combo shots. And so you can just go ahead and keep giving the combo vaccines.
Isn't that amazing? That was the only thing they were concerned about. Can we tweak this a little bit by giving them a combo vaccine or a singular vaccine? No, it doesn't make any difference. So go ahead and do this to them, even though, and to repeat these numbers, 112% increase in respiratory support needed post-vaccine. This is the Journal of American Medical Association saying this. A 257% increase in sepsis. That's a life-threatening infection. Just go ahead and do it because we have to follow this vaccination schedule. That is the most important thing to them, isn't it? It isn't the patient's health. It isn't their suffering. It isn't subjecting them to life-threatening situations. It's sticking to the vaccine schedule.
Right. I mean, just to clarify, they didn't actually have sepsis increase that much, but they are saying that they had that big of an increase in testing, surveying, and starting to treat for sepsis, which basically just says, when I talked in that other interview, that these babies have apnea and bradycardia is a nice example that they're having a hard time, you know, remembering to breathe. And so then their heart rate drops and things like that. That's a lot of what they're seeing, temp instability, inability to tolerate feeds. And so these babies are vastly showing big cues that we're normally extremely concerned about in the pre-immunization period or any time before discharge, because these babies have immune systems that are so underdeveloped that if you wait too long to treat them, they are going to have very bad outcomes and possibly die. But in the post-immunization period, we're seeing an increase in that. And apparently we're not worried because the whole point of the study was to make sure that these babies get vaccinated on time and that it doesn't matter what you're vaccinating with.
You know, when we look at these babies with low birth weights or premature babies, they're really, I think, canaries in a coal mine. We have to look at this and say, if they have this much of an increase in respiratory issues and response to these vaccinations, I wonder personally if there's some connection to SIDS. A lot of people have talked about sudden infant death syndrome and just babies that stop breathing. I wonder if there's, we don't have anything to back that up in this study, but certainly it makes you wonder, makes me wonder when I look at all of these respiratory issues that are caused for these babies that already have a challenged health system.
Well, there's two ways to look at it. You know, premature babies are not supposed to be breathing yet. It is normal for them to have some apnea and bradycardia. Just developmental wise and immature neurological systems. But having an increase is always a cue that something is going on. They don't address that in that study. We do have some studies from, I believe, the 50s following the DTaP shot showing increased or just apnea, but also just a vast change in respiratory breathing patterns. And of course, we haven't looked at that in decades, so we really don't have any data currently on that.
You know, it's interesting when I look at this report, Michelle. One of the things they say, laying this out in the abstract, the introduction to it, they say.
Now, that was just part of a longer 14-minute clip, but here is a highly qualified nurse, an educated nurse, teaching nurse, and saying that we are killing babies, deforming babies' immune systems, injuring babies, because there is a protocol. And the protocol says give all these babies a vaccine instead of examining to see if whether or not the baby is the right birth weight. And so they're engaged in a terrible form of a baby injury. And it should stop. Now, according to the latest information, and there is a big move towards profit over safety. The Center for Disease Control names 271 new vaccines. Let me repeat that. They now have 271 new vaccines that are going to be on the market. And they're going to tell you, try to convince you, that they want you to use these, that you need to use these. I claim that the CDC is corrupt, always has been corrupt, and remains corrupt. And as part of the proof of that corruption, that has been overly influenced by pharmaceutical interest. We have a Dr. Thompson, and Dr. Thompson, on the record and with documentation, showed that he and his entire crew at the CDC, they lied, they manipulated the study data to eliminate our knowledge that over 300% increase in autism in African-American young boys under 36 months of age from the vaccines. They knew what they were doing was wrong. They conspired. They met the full term of conspiracy and met in secret and had an agenda to lie and destroy the evidence. And everyone brought garbage bags to destroy the copies so there would be no evidence. What no one knew was Dr. Thompson intuitively knew and intellectually knew that this was against the law. And he so stated that. So he kept the copies. He's given those copies to a member of Congress. That member of Congress has now read those into the congressional record. So we're not dealing with specious, speculative rumor. We're not dealing with innuendo. We're dealing with prima facie evidence, hard evidence. So what should we do about it? I'm going to read you something from one of the members of the Pacifica National Board and the local station board and one of the most staunch supporters of WBAI, our sister station, for decades, Stephen M. Brown. Quote, astonishing testimony by Dr. Thompson today. However, why would his call for yet another congressional hearing accomplish anything? In this instance, any African American who has been or whose child has been vaccinated has standing to bring a direct lawsuit against those who destroyed the records. Those persons can then be offered leniency if they cooperate in naming those above them who gave the orders to destroy the records, and so on up the chain to wherever it leads. Well, it's going to lead to the director. That's where exactly where it's going to lead, who left the CDC to take a multi-million dollar job with the pharmaceutical industry overseeing vaccines. Talk about a conflict of interest in the revolving door. So Steve is correct, and I verified this with several attorneys. So I'm asking members of the African American community, if you know any children that were vaccinated in the last, let's say the last 15 years, then you could be a part of this because they were covering up the information about the link between vaccine and injury, and they covered it up. So you do not have to get the government's permission to sue them. They are not protected as such. You can't sue the government without the government's permission. You can, however, sue anyone who has broken the law or you believe or you can prove has broken the law, and Dr. Thompson's already acknowledged it. He's admitted it. He's gone on the record. He's provided the documentation. Now's the time for mass action. The African-American community should be outraged, just like they were at the Tuskegee experiment when you were used as human guinea pigs. So flood these people at the CDC with lawsuits. Flood them. I'd love to see 100,000, 200,000 lawsuits hit them, and then one of them is going to turn in the direction of Dr. Thompson, and then it's all going to come out. I'm Gary Nall. Let's now go to my guest who is standing by. He is Dr. Mark Grossman. He is a doctor of optometry, and he also does acupuncture. He is at the Summers Eye Center in Summers, New York. It's S-O-M-M-E-R-S, and in New Paltz. And nationally, he has become known as the holistic eye doctor, and he incorporates natural vision modalities such as acupuncture and diet, nutrition, and eye exercises. He is the founder of the international best-selling book, Magic Eye Beyond 3D. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you, Gary. Great to hear from you again.
I think everyone wants to be able to improve poor vision or vision defects if they knew it was possible. People assume that poor vision is almost a natural process, can only be corrected by glasses, lenses, or surgery. But you also know of the alternative. So I'm going to just stand back here and let you roll and give us definitive, in-depth, as much as you can on the air, protocols for cataracts, glaucoma, macular degeneration, and diabetic retinopathy, and any other eye condition, especially those that might impact women in menopause, postmenopause, or anything that may affect women more than men. The forum is yours.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for this opportunity. I've been doing this for about 35 years now, and the main issue with many of these chronic eye conditions is that you come into an eye doctor's office, and let's say it's a cataract, and we look inside your eye, and we say, ooh, you've got the beginning of a cataract. And the patient looks at you, you look at them, and the patient says, oh, what can we do about that? And you say, well, not much. All we're going to do is we'll watch it, and if it gets worse, we can do surgery. So that's the standard line, as many and thousands of people have heard. And then we may have glaucoma issues. So we have patients who come in, and we see the check their eyes, and they have a little high eye pressure. And normal eye pressure is, let's say, 10 to 22, and their eye pressures are, let's say, 22 or 24. And we look inside the eye, and we check their optic nerves, and we do specialized testing such as an OCT, which gives us a three-dimensional picture of the optic nerves and see how well they're functioning and visual fields. And we say, you know what? You're a glaucoma suspect. And the patient goes back in their seat, I'm a suspect? But what does that mean? They say, well, it doesn't mean anything, but you know what? You're a little vulnerable to possibility of glaucoma, so what are we going to do? We're going to watch that, too. So the Western approach and the traditional approach to eye care is a wait and see, because basically all we have at our disposal is medication or possible surgery. Now, I'm not saying at all that medication and surgery is not important. I refer out for it all the time. I work in an integrative medical practice where we do write medications. We do have ophthalmologists who do surgery. So when surgery is needed, I am full, you know, go ahead to recommending it. But the question that I like is, what can I do while I'm watching it? Well, if you look into the nutritional literature, the acupuncture literature, the herbal literature, there are many, many things we can do for these conditions. So I'll mention a couple of them, and here's where it gets a little tricky, because I'm going to talk in generalities, because when we say cataracts, there might be three or four different kinds of cataracts or more. Posterior subcapsulary, nuclear, anterior. In glaucoma, there's many different kinds of possibilities of glaucoma, from narrow-angle glaucoma to open-angle, which is the one that most people might get, to pseudo-exfoliation glaucoma. So we have to always work with this on an individual basis. But in the literature, especially for cataracts, one of the things we have are N-acetylcarnosine drops. So there's eye drops based on a book called Cataract Breakthrough that you can get sort of, they come from Russia, and there's an eye drop called CanSee, which the N-acetylcarnosine will help break up the glycation, the proteins coagulating together in the lens to help break down the cataracts. So that's one of the eye drops that I might use. Plus, there's a homeopathic remedy called Succinaria, and this is a homeopathic remedy for helping with cataracts too, especially early cataracts. I was amazed one time when I was first in practice, maybe 35 years ago, I was in a hospital working, and the other eye doctor said, look at this. We were looking through the physician PDR, the physician's desk reference of ophthalmology, and right there was a homeopathic remedy called Cineria for cataracts. Never mentioned in school at all. So Cineria is very important. Also, in terms of most cataracts, in the general ones, have been shown to be low in an antioxidant called glutathione. So we try to recommend things to build glutathione levels, such as alpha-lipoic acid, N-acetylcysteine, selenium. So any way we can build glutathione levels is very important for the cataracts. Vitamin C, many cataracts, and vitamin C will help build glutathione levels too, have been shown to be low in vitamin C. So we develop a nutritional approach, herbal, nutritional, homeopathic approach to helping with the reduction of cataracts, which I've seen, totally have seen cataracts
okay,
get better, not
hello.
All.
I need you to be specific. In other words, give us a homeopath, spell it. And we're going to run out of time if you don't give us the protocols. We're looking now for the protocols.
Okay.
With
so
each
the protocol
one, okay?
for cataracts would be Cineria, homeopathic remedy, eye drops, spelled C-I-N-E-R-A-R-I-A. The N-acetylcarnosine drops are acetylcarnosine drops. The drops that we use are called CAN-C, C-A-N hyphen C. In terms of alpha-lipoic acid, I usually give about 150 milligrams of alpha-lipoic acid, 600 milligrams of N-acetylcysteine, 2,000 milligrams of vitamin C, 200 micrograms of selenium, and then sometimes I'll also use, if I can find the glutathione builders in an intraoral or sublingual form, I'll try to use that because it's more absorbable. So that's basically my cataract protocol. For glaucoma, what we want to do is we want to do a neuroprotective protocol for glaucoma. So there's lots of nutrients that have been shown to be neuroprotective. Again, alpha-lipoic acid, I usually use about 200 milligrams. And both for the cataracts and for the glaucoma, I'll try to use like an R form or a sublingual form because the R form is more absorbable in alpha-lipoic acid. N-acetylcysteine again, about 500 milligrams. Ginkgo biloba, 120 milligrams, has been shown to increase visual fields and be neuroprotective for the optic nerve. Grapeseed extract, about 100 to 200 milligrams, and bilberry, 100 to 200 milligrams. Also, taurine, about 750 milligrams, and also because I feel that a lot of optic nerve things are circulation, I always recommend about 100 milligrams of coenzyme Q10. In addition to that, magnesium is very helpful, about 500 milligrams, balanced with calcium in a 2-to-1 ratio, and I'll do about 250 milligrams of calcium. So that would be for the optic nerve neuroprotection. There's also a medication called aminoguanidine, A-M-I-N-O-G-U-A-N-I-D-I-N-E. About 150 milligrams a day of aminoguanidine, which is also an anti-aging, anti-glycation remedy, has been shown to be helpful for neuroprotective for glaucoma. In terms of helping lower the eye pressure, there is an Ayurvedic herb called Coleus forscoli, and I'll usually recommend either in a tincture form or 100 milligrams of Coleus forscoli. So that's my general protocol for glaucoma, and in both of those cases, in glaucoma, acupuncture has also been very helpful to lower the eye pressure. The third condition I just want to talk about, because it's super important, is macular degeneration. Macular degeneration is the number one cause of irreversible blindness in the United States. So the most important foods for macular degeneration for the eye is the number one food would be kale. kale and orange peppers. And why kale and orange peppers? Because they are the highest concentration of lutein, L-U-T-E-I-N, which is a carotenoid that's found in the macula of the eye, and zeaxanthin, Z-E-A-X-A-N-T-H-I-N, lutein and zeaxanthin. There's also another carotenoid that has been shown to be even as powerful in there, miso-zeaxanthin. So I tried to come up with different supplements that will have at least 10 milligrams of lutein, 10 milligrams of zeaxanthin, and about 10 milligrams of miso-zeaxanthin. So I'm always, those are my most important things for macular degeneration, along with the bilberry and the grapeseed extract to be able to keep the blood in the vessels, because you don't want macular degeneration to go from dry to wet, so you want to make sure that the blood vessels are as strong as possible. It's also been shown that black currant extract, C3G, is also a very, very good supplement, again, for the blood vessels and the blood vessel walls in the macula. Very important for both the macular degeneration and for the glaucoma to do specific testing, such as an OCT test of the macula and an OCT test of the optic nerve, so you can actually see the changes that are happening in the retina and how deep they go. And actually, through the nutritional protocols that I'm talking about, I've seen actual improvement in the macula and the optic nerves.
Okay, so, we're out of time, Mark, but you've given us a lot of good quality details, and that's what we need at this time. And they can do additional reading, and we thank you very much for being on here. And give us your website, please.
My website is naturaleyecare.com. It's about 300 pages of research and protocols for different eye diseases. Do you need a phone number of it or no?
Yes.
Phone number for Natural Eye Care, direct number is 845-255-8222. And we do free phone consults for anybody who needs information on eye care.
Thank you very much. Dr. Mark, M-A-R-C, Grossman from Somers, New York. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on tomorrow's program. Have a nice day.